TUC Radio, San Francisco. Time of Useful Consciousness.
Behind the scenes of the Millennium Meeting, Harry Belafonte was the surprise guest of honor at the teach-in of the International Forum on Globalization in New York. The world-famous singer, actor, and activist gave a spontaneous and very moving account of his life. Born in Harlem and raised in Jamaica, Belafonte made his debut in 1949 in a New York club. He began singing songs of social significance, such as his own song, Recognition, and quickly became a cult figure and later a national pop star with his Banana Boat song. His introduction into Hollywood came in 1952. He was the first African-American to play a leading role in a movie. Later, he ran afoul of the Un-American Activities Committee. They confronted him with a story that he had punched his fist through a friend's car window in anger when he heard that the Supreme Court had turned down the death penalty appeal of Julius and Ethel Rosenberg. Employment became difficult for him, but he always remained a spokesperson for the black community. He participated in the civil rights movement in the South. In Washington, D.C., he marched against the war in Vietnam. He supported worker rights from banana workers in the Caribbean to garment workers in New York. Only last year, in November of 1999, he participated in a human rights tour through Georgia in support of black farmers who are losing their land. That tour was organized by Food First and the Institute for Policy Studies. Harry Belafonte's appearance on stage was greeted with a huge round of applause. He radiates the energy of a young man, and only his voice, that is now that of an elder, gives away the more than 70 years of his life. Here is Harry Belafonte.
Thank you. Let me first of all express my great sense of privilege to be invited to be here and to speak. When I watched the events of Seattle unfold, I was regretful that I was not there. And I have been forever taunted by a very dear and close colleague of mine by the name of Danny Glover, who was there, and said to me, "Boy, you missed the big one." The fact that there is friendly competitiveness between us is much on the personal side of our story. But I'm very privileged and rewarded by the fact that Danny, as a cultural worker, as an artist, has chosen to make the kind of commitment that he has made to the eradication of global injustice. When I hear about globalization and all the titles that emerge that identify a new moment of energy in our constant battle against injustice and oppression and banking, takeover, I am always touched by the fact that all that's really changed is just the title. The struggle is very basically the same. And I stand here somewhat privileged as I look out in the audience and I only see a few gray hairs or people who carry them. The rest are filled with color and ill-kept. Which kind of tells me that I'm talking to a new crowd, a younger crowd. Culture has always been for me a remarkable force, and its power has consistently demonstrated itself both to the positive as well as the negative side of the human ledger, where it has chosen to be positive. Culture has done much to illuminate, to instruct, and to inspire people to make commitments to do things that perhaps ordinarily they might not be willing to do. Where it has chosen to display mischief, it has also done that with enormous power and with very, very difficult results. My first experience with globalization, as we are constantly defining it, really had to do with my first time I remember a motion picture that I saw in 1935. It's called Tarzan of the Apes. And it was then that I had my first insight into globalization. Here was Africa, as depicted in this film, with a mass of black folk from some place yet to be named. And the people who inhabited this environment were incapable of dealing with the environment, had no relationship to the creatures that inhabited the environment. As a matter of fact, existed most fearfully in the presence of these creatures. And as the plot unfolds and people come in to do their various bits of mischief, the great hero of the moment, who not only saves the people, these ignorant people, but also saves the environment and has this wonderful rapport with all the creatures of the earth that permeate this place, is this super white man. And it isn't just that he is so gorgeous looking and rippled muscles and beautiful hair and stunning smile, but what really is defying, and this tells you about real power, he has no language. The only word in his vocabulary is IER. It applies to everything. How simple and how wonderful. But as a child sitting in Harlem, looking at this magic unfold on this big screen, the impact that film had on me and the debate that my family and others engaged in right after seeing it, because you have to understand that I was born at a time when movies was the most magical thing that ever happened to humankind. It was very new. It was for us as awesome and as magical and as promising as the internet is today for my granddaughter. But the impact that film made was to give me in my earliest years a sense of who and what I wanted to be and what I did not want to be. I knew that very early on, the one thing that I did not want to be most in life was an African. There was something so debased and despicable about these creatures that ran around on the screen looking so stupid and being so shiftless and mindless. And when we, in our childlike play in the parks in our ghetto, and we divided sides and took on who wanted to be an Indian or who wanted to be a cowboy or who wanted to be Tarzan and who wanted to be an African. It's always interesting to me that as children of color, as African Americans in Harlem, nobody wanted to be the Native American and no one wanted to be the African. We all wanted to be the Union Army. We all wanted to be part of the cavalry. We wanted to be Custer's number one man if it came to a conflict with Native Americans. And we all wanted to be Tarzan. And as a matter of fact, climbed the trees in the park and leaped from branch to branch, trying to display our right to the title when we began to choose up sides on the Africa game. It was also culture, however, that gave me a balanced view. Because in the same community, we had film that was brought into our community, done by honorable men and women who saw life in another way. And they created a little entity called Negro News. And in the Negro News, a little clip that went on in between the main features of the presentation at the movie house we may have been visiting, we had a chance to see what black people were doing in the world through our little newsreel. And it was here that I saw another side of Africa. I saw Haile Selassie. And I remember very early on, in the same time I was looking at Tarzan and watching John Wayne and others do their mischief with Native Americans, I also had a chance to see Haile Selassie. I had a chance to see his plea before the League of Nations. And I had a chance to watch the leaders of those nations sit in forum listening to Haile Selassie and later rejecting his overture. It was not too long after that we were able to see through the Negro newsreel Italy's fascist forces invade Ethiopia and the barefoot soldiers rise up and do battle against the invader. Seeing this aspect of Africa sent all of us as young children back to the drawing board to reevaluate our opinion of Africa. We found nobility in Haile Selassie. We certainly found a figure that was far more admirable than the one that we'd seen in Tarzan of the Apes depicting Africans. And certainly the injustice of the fascist forces of Italy invading Ethiopia said all that we needed to know. Further elaborated on by family and friends and people in our environment who debated fascism and what it meant to the world at large. Globalization, as we know it now, has not just taken over turf and seeks to march in and command their place in societies that really don't want them. It has its ramifications in how we look at the way in which they are interpreted by how they, in control of culture, forces culture to define them. In a recent meeting in Havana, a number of cultural voices met from all over the globe. Our purpose was to discuss globalization and culture. In this exchange, we all concluded that the power of culture and its influence, especially through film and television, and its influence on the hearts and minds of people were really far more devastating than we have been willing to really reflect on and examine. When I go to places in the world where I have been inspired and been encouraged by the voices that I hear from indigenous people sitting in countries that I am familiar with their history and what they're attempting to achieve in the pursuit of their own democratic goals and ideals, I watch how the peoples of those countries are being distanced from their own voice, from their own art, from their own history. Because the power of corporations who control culture, those companies that control television, those countries that control, those corporations that control what is made to be shown to the peoples of the world, carry the most insidious mission of all the apparati that I know of around that tries to soften each community for the onslaught that is to come when these corporations finally take over the turf. They have long since been there. They have long since co-opted the artists in those countries that I speak of to speak the tongue of the corporate master. The film industry in many countries in Latin America no longer expresses the culture of the indigenous people or the history of those cultures and those countries. It speaks only to the history and the glory of America and corporate America. And it tries to put us in many shades and many colors and in many dimensions as being the holiest of all. And as you go around from country to country, you find that on the marquees of most of the theaters, the music coming out of most of the stores is music that is manufactured by the Northern Hemispheric powers that control the medium of communication in this globalization effort from the United States and from Europe. When I have watched this unfold and the role that I have been asked from time to time to play in the process and my rejection of it, and beyond just the rejection, my resistance to it by going forth and explaining to audiences and to people everywhere that there is a insidious movement afoot through culture to co-opt truth, to paint a picture of us one to the other in ways that are unfair and inhumane and incorrect. I also find that those who are in power that control that system also determines the extent to which I can work or the extent to which I can be seen. This is not a new phenomena. I really began to understand censorship and the blacklist most fully during the McCarthy period in this country. And having resisted social injustice, the reward for that effort was to be defined by the committees in the Congress of the United States of America and by certain journalists and by certain others who made vigilante groups and whatnot. I was defined as anti-democratic, as anti-American, as unpatriotic. And for that definition, I was then cursed with the sentence to a voiceless place for a while because I could not work. I was unemployable. The fact that I shared that title with others who were truly great men and women was of some comfort. But it didn't do much to put bread on the table. And this conflict and this battle has been going on ever since, from my perspective, ever since the days of McCarthyism. And from the days of globalization of culture, it has been going on ever since I was an infant. And I watched through the dual privilege of growing up in Harlem in America because I was born there, and as an African American I had one set of experiences, and because my parents were immigrants and came from the Caribbean and I had to go there as a child to be brought up during certain periods, I had the privilege of seeing how colonialism worked and how the peoples of the colonized part of the world lived. And I saw in both those places the commonality of each. I saw that we were not really too far apart, except in cultural style and in the way in which we presented our art and through what our tongue happened to impart, that we were not distanced at all in terms of who it was that put us in the positions of the oppression in which we found ourselves. And I've often felt that in order to change this way of life, we needed to be able to reach out as cultural workers to fellow workers all over the world to explain and to embrace them and they us in our common march against the oppression and the totalitarianism of money and banks and what they force people to do. It was this concept and this thought that led me to my earliest years with the United Nations. It was my good fortune to not only know, but to be embraced and welcomed by a great American woman by the name of Eleanor Roosevelt. In our years together and in the things that we did, I was always struck by her deep and great commitment to the United Nations and particularly to her feelings about human rights and the role that she played in helping develop the human rights platform. Through Eleanor Roosevelt, I came to know a lot about what the world could hope for and expect from the United Nations. And having learned from my earliest years of watching Haile Selassie on the Negro News and seeing what happened in the inability for the League of Nations to live up to its mandate and to a greater promise, saw what happened when the world went into chaos because it had no international forum on which to be able to express itself and to unfold its grievances and to find some peaceful way in which to settle differences. That led, of course, to the Second World War, and that war, which was the war to end all wars, also held some promise for the future, for me certainly. When I joined the United States Navy to participate in that war, I truly believed that the mission was to end the philosophy of white supremacy, that the philosophy was to bring the world together into a new democratic order, and that if we could defeat fascism and end that nonsense once and for all, that the world would be open to a new moment in our evolution and in our history, and that we would shape the world according to the concepts that were given us when we were propagandized on why we were committed to that war. But those of us who were of color, who participated in that war, came home only to find out that such benevolence as America, giving all of its citizens of color the right to vote and the right to participate fully and to have an equal playing field in the great American dream, was not forthcoming. As a matter of fact, this country mobilized itself vigorously to put us back in our place, to get out of our heads and our minds those things that we had been led to believe were the principles of why we fought the Second World War. And before we knew it, black citizens in this country were being hung, shot, drowned, beaten, imprisoned, and just defiled all over the place. But how interesting that while that was happening to us, we looked around and we saw others in Asia and in Latin America and in Africa who also had the same idea that the Second World War and the defeat of white supremacy and the defeat of the fascist philosophy was that we would all be in a new place in the new order of things. After all, the Allies, who are the protectors of democracy and those who most professed to this ideal, how interesting that they should have been England, Belgium, France, Portugal. Well, Portugal wasn't one of the Allies, so I kind of just look at them and I sometimes stutter when I get to Portugal. Especially having seen their special kind of mischief in Angola and in Mozambique. I all of a sudden discovered while we were here in America resisting and struggling and forming groups and pockets of groups and people and finding new titles and new ways in which to energize ourselves, we were finding a great corollary. We found alliances with people all over the world who were in struggle for the same things in their own way. And their ways were not too different than ours. And it was here in the United Nations that many of us saw hope, great hope. This forum, which was so nobly put together, and what the Human Rights Declaration said were going to be the concepts by which we would govern ourselves and seek to mold our future. It was a wonderful thing to see. And then soon after that, we discovered the role that culture could play in working to help develop and to support the mandate that had been set. Is that a bell that tells me it's over? Is that what that means? My God, how fast it goes. I guess the point that I'm making is this, that I come from a history of struggle that has covered 73 years. And in that time, from the time of the Great Depression in this country, through the Second World War, through the colonial struggle, through it all, through the wars, through the peace, through civil rights, we come to a new moment in our evolution. But once again, we're coming together to find the method and the way in which to deal with the new millennium, the way in which to settle our problems. The thing that I would most suggest as a simple instrument and tool would be to go back and to take a look at what those who preceded you did and how they did it and what they aspired to and the methodology they applied in achieving their ends. Those tools that they used are still very, very much available, are still very much there, are still very much required. And I hope that as this convention continues and as we meet again and again in all parts of the world, doing our thing to try to illuminate and try to galvanize masses of people to take charge of their lives, that we will find in our future as much victory and as much glory for what we do as we have found in the past. Thank you.
That was Harry Belafonte, the world-famous actor, singer, and activist. He spoke in September 2000 at a teach-in organized by the International Forum on Globalization. That teach-in was calling attention to the complicity of the leadership of the UN in the movement towards globalization and the expansion of the World Trade Organization. This program is part of an 8-part series on globalization at the United Nations. You can get Harry Belafonte's talk on a 1-hour tape for $12. The transcript of this full 4-hour series is $12 as well. For a credit card order, call us toll-free at 1-877-TUC-TAPE and let us know if you want the transcript or the tape or both. That's 1-877-TUC-TAPE. Or send your $12 check to TUC Radio, Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141. That's Box 410009, San Francisco, California, 94141, USA. TUC Radio's website is www.tucradio.org. The music is by G.S. Sarshdev. My name is Mariah Gelarden. Thank you for listening.